Okay. Now, in general, the massive support being given by Western industrialists, chiefly American industrialists, because we were the dominant industrial power at the time, and of course still are, the massive aid being given to Hitler and the fascist governments, generally speaking, went unnoticed. There weren't too many people calling attention to it. Now, one of the very few organizations or interests to attempt to get to the bottom of the industrialists, of the Western industrialists' support for Hitler and their arming of Hitler, was a Senate committee known as the Nye Committee, or a congressional committee known as the Nye Committee. Now, Senator Nye, and along with Senators Bone and Truman, were very concerned with the munitions makers and industrialists and their aid to Hitler, so they formed a committee to look into it. Now, the fellow who was in many ways the driving force behind the Nye Committee and steering it in the direction of investigating these American and German industrial connections was a fellow by the name of Alger Hiss, last name H-I-S-S. Alger Hiss was a young, very intelligent New Deal lawyer, and Alger Hiss acted as legal counsel to the Nye Committee, which was investigating the munitions makers and industrialists' aid to Germany. And basically, Alger Hiss was one of the very few people who was willing to go out on a limb and to devote some effort to trying to uncover these fascist connections that American and other and Western... Well, basically, the Nye Committee was concerned with American connections to Nazi Germany. I'm going to read you about this, about Alger Hiss's work for the Nye Committee. The following passage comes from a book called Friendship and Fratricide. That was authored by a man named Dr. Meyer Zeligs, Z-E-L-I-G-S, and it's copyrighted in 1967 in hardcover by the Viking Press. This book is a sort of a psychoanalytic account of the Hiss-Chambers confrontation, the confrontation between Alger Hiss and Whitaker Chambers, who successfully accused him of being a communist spy. Okay, so Friendship and Fratricide by Meyer Zeligs, copyright 1967, speaks of Hiss and his work for the Nye Committee as follows. As legal counsel to the Nye Committee, Hiss passed on legal questions that the committee wanted ruled upon and gave them opinions on matters of law. He gathered evidence relating to the activities of the munitions industries and handled, as an examiner, four or five specific topics assigned to him. The first of these examinations began on September 10th, 1934, when he questioned John S. Allard, A-L-L-A-R-D, president of Curtis Wright Export Corporation, regarding the manufacture and sale of aircraft to foreign countries. Okay, we've just looked at Curtis Wright selling dive bombers or giving dive bombing to the Axis. Hiss went on to officials of the DuPont Company, reaching his height in the questioning of Bernard Baruch. Fully equipped beforehand with all the evidence he needed, Hiss was a meticulous cross-examiner. He received acclaim among the New Dealers, the liberals, and left-wingers, and angered Baruch and his friends. Hiss soon began making a name for himself and was asked to speak at various clubs and societies regarding the work of the Nye Committee. So keep in mind, among the sort of sounds of silence that prevailed concerning the American support for the Axis and Hitler in particular, Alger Hiss was one of the very few people whose voices was raised in condemnation of this aid for Hitler.
Yes, and also Alger Hiss, you might bear in mind that on one side of the coin we have Alger Hiss cross-examining Bernard Baruch and others for the Nye Committee on this collusion with the Axis. On the other side, later on in court, we had Whitaker Chambers. We're going to be talking about him, too, a little later on. Okay, while we're talking about this this collusion between various elements of finance and business and the Axis powers, we're going to go on and touch on another rather interesting footnote gentleman by the name of Montague Norman. Now, this next section here is from a book called The Nazis Go Underground, which we are going to be quoting from at length. I don't know if we've announced the publishing dates, etc., on this one.
No, The Nazis Go Underground was authored by a man named Kurt Ries, last name R-I-E-S-S. It was published in hardcover by Doubleday, Duran and Company in 1944. Of course, now that's Doubleday and Company. In 1944, it was Doubleday, Duran and Company. Kurt Ries was a prominent anti-fascist writer, very well known in his day, but like so many of the authors that we're talking about now, his work and his name have simply disappeared from the historical record for all intents and purposes. this book, The Nazis Go Underground, the title might seem kind of melodramatic to many of you. Keep in mind that in 1944, the United States was at war with the Axis powers, and what might seem melodramatic to us today was commonplace in those days. And, well, perhaps, although the book is it's not very well known, the best single recommendation for The Nazis Go Underground is the books in whose bibliography it appears, just about all of the really good books about German espionage during World War II and about the covert side of the Third Reich have The Nazis Go Underground in its bibliography. So it's a little-known but very important work.
All right, not only is Mr. Rice, or Reese, however it's pronounced, I guess it's Rice, right?
Reese. Well, that's how everybody I know pronounces it is spelled Rice.
Anyway, well, not only is he talking about Montague Norman, but another name is going to come up, and that is that of Hjalmar Schacht. And the first name, because it's an interesting one, is spelled H-J-A-L-M-A-R, last name S-C-H-A-C-H-T. So Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht. Oh, you wanted to get that middle name?
Yep. Yes. Because he was actually the son of a German banker. He was born in the United States, and this banker was stationed at the New York branch of a large German bank. So he actually was born in the United States and was named Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht. And the same German-American industrial axis that we've been talking about gave birth almost literally to Hjalmar Schacht.
That's right. And it's also rather... Rather ironic in view of the fact that we're going to be talking about the collusion between a British financial power and the German finance minister. It's rather interesting that the German finance minister's middle name should be Horace Greeley, who, after all, was the famous American who said, "Go west, young man." And that's indeed what Hjalmar and his buddies were planning to do with help from that same British financial whiz. Anyway, so reading from The Nazis Go Underground. So, Dr. Schacht, if he wished, had every opportunity to talk directly or indirectly with banking representatives of the Allies. The most outstanding of them is a man who had been Schacht's closest friend for his entire lifetime, Montague Norman, former governor of the Bank of England, whom Schacht, until only very recently, must have met frequently in Basel. Mr. Montague Norman, up to his retirement in April 1944, the greatest single power in British finance, has long been in favor of a Nazi regime, as far as Germany was concerned, of course. Undoubtedly, he was motivated only by the reflection that a pro-Nazi course in Germany would be best for the British Empire. As history proves, this was not a very intelligent view to take, but there is nothing to prove that it might not have been his honest conviction. In any case, Montague Norman has, and I remind you this was written in 1944, in any case, Montague Norman has been aiding Hjalmar Schacht, and thus, of course, Hitler, for many years. In 1932, there was a meeting between him and Sir Henry Dieterding, D-E-T-E-R-D-I-N-G, in the United States, at which the two, Norman and Sir Henry Dieterding, discuss subsidies for the Führer and possible ways of aiding him if he came to power.
Sir Henry Dieterding was the chairman of Royal Dutch Shell Oil Company.
Indeed. And at which the two discuss subsidies for the Führer and possible ways of aiding him if he came to power. Early in 1934, Norman met with more than a dozen outstanding financiers and industrialists of England in his private office in the Bank of England. Norman made a speech to the group in which he referred to the Nazis as a, quote, great stabilizing force, which would come in handy against Soviet Russia. Again, Norman was in favor of financing Hitler. The same year, 1934, saw a number of conferences with Hjalmar Schacht in Badenweiler, a small German spa. At that time, the British government did not quite see eye to eye with the governor of the Bank of England. Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin, in particular, was less than lukewarm to the Hitler cause. During the years 1935 to 1937, however, more and more members of the government went over to Montague Norman. First, Defense Minister Inskip, then Sir John Simon, and finally, Neville Chamberlain, Chancellor of the Exchequer. This move on Chamberlain's part proved to be a decisive factor in shaping his political career. A few months later, he became Baldwin's successor. As Prime Minister, by the way, and we're going to get back to that in just a moment. In December 1938, after Czechoslovakia had been sold out at Munich, Herr Schacht visited England. he was a guest at Montague Norman's house. No statement was issued concerning the purpose of this visit. It was declared to be purely personal. 1 month later, this purely personal visit was returned by Norman when, on his way to Basel, he stopped over in Berlin to see Dr. Schacht. Again, nothing definite leaked out about their conversations. It was rumored, however, that the two men were trying to form some common policy of expanding markets for Germany and of settling Germany's foreign debts. There were also rumors about British export credits for Germany to the tune of $375 million, or thereabouts. Hitler himself, however, saw to the extension of markets for Germany when, a few weeks later, he marched into Prague, contrary to his promises in Munich. And, shortly before the outbreak of World War II, Montague Norman did his friend Schacht another, and presumably last, service when he handed over to him the Czech gold deposited in the Bank of England. Okay, well, let's look at a couple of things there that are rather interesting in light of Montague Norman and Hjalmar Schacht's connections there. The very fact that Neville Chamberlain became Prime Minister of England after his conversion to Montague Norman's side after his falling into line with Montague Norman's view of the Nazis as a great stabilizing influence. And, of course, it was Neville Chamberlain who signed the pact and, in fact, was the impetus behind the pact which allowed the Nazis to walk into the Rhineland and later Czechoslovakia unopposed, and which gave them a large head start on World War II and was also pretty demoralizing to the rest of Europe, especially those immediately bordering on Germany. Anyway, it's rather interesting in those lights that Neville Chamberlain did happen to reach the position of power, and Dave has advanced the theory, which I think is certainly worth considering, that in fact this later handing over to Hitler of the falsely easy terms in Munich was perhaps a quid pro quo for Neville Chamberlain's ascension to the high spot in British politics. It's also interesting, too, that just shortly after Germany is marched into Czechoslovakia, that Schacht and Norman get together again, and suddenly Montague Norman, just on the eve practically of war, decides to free up the Czech gold assets in British to turn over to the Nazis, who had in fact just illegally walked into Czechoslovakia.
It's an important point to make, because usually Chamberlain is portrayed as sort of an incompetent ninny, and Munich conference is made out to be Hitler sort of just taking Chamberlain to the cleaners and pulling the wool over his eyes. Well, again, we can't say for sure, but it seems a reasonable question to ask in light of the fact that his political association, or as Niptuck put it, conversion to Montague Norman's political philosophy was instrumental in Neville Chamberlain's rise to the Prime Minister's position. One has to ask, was he repaying a political favor when he basically handed Czechoslovakia over to Hitler? Keep in mind that the Czechoslovakian armaments industry, notably the Škoda works, were incredibly coveted. Whether they were coveted by Hitler, were very, very important and gave Hitler a much, much larger war-making capacity than he would otherwise have had. Also put him closer to Russia. And keep this in mind. Keep in mind the fact that the pro-Nazi elements within the various countries had a great deal to do with the initial successes of the Nazis in the Western Front. The role of the Fifth Column movements in Western Europe in subverting their armies on the battlefield is something we'll go into when we talk about the rise of fascism. But keep in mind that this sort of pattern was very common. There's a book which is in some university libraries called The Triumph of Treason by a man named Pierre de Cot, last name D-E-C-O-T, who was the French Minister of Aviation during the Social Front by a man named Léon Blum, B-L-U-M, in France. And Decaux describes, and he would remember now, he was the French Minister of Aviation, he describes in no uncertain terms how the French fascists, the pro-Hitler French, the so-called cagoulards, or the hooded ones, basically subverted French aircraft production and made for a very, very weak French air force, which then succumbed very quickly to Hermann Goering's peaceful air force that he wrote about in the Hearst papers. Okay, now keep in mind the skullduggery, the duplicity that went on the battlefield during World War II, because we're going to be going into that in a second. Now, I'd like to throw a name out to you now that we're going to touch on now, where he's going to figure very importantly, not only in later in this broadcast and in the second part of Looking Back from 1984, But we're going to come up against this fellow many, many times in the future. We've already looked at him in the pilot Radio Free America series that we did on the Guns of November about the Kennedy assassination. This fellow is named John J. McCloy. And John J. McCloy was Assistant Secretary of War during World War II. The Defense Department was called the War Department in those days, and the Secretary of Defense was called the Secretary of War. Well, John J. McCloy and a number of other men named Robert Levet, Robert Patterson, and Harvey Bundy were sort of regarded as the leg men, unquote, for Secretary of War Henry Stimson. In other words, they really ran the War Department. Now, John J. McCloy is a very, very important figure. As I said, we're going to come up against him again. I'd like to read you a couple of very, very short pieces of information about McCloy. These pieces of information come from an article called Minister Without Portfolio. That article is authored by Alan Brinkley, last name Brinkley, and it was published in Harper's Magazine in February of 1983. Now, John J. McCloy had been working with many German political and industrial leaders. He was a lawyer, and he was settling a lawsuit filed against, a massive international lawsuit. Now, as an adjunct to this lawsuit, this international lawsuit, he came to know the top Nazi leaders. And one in particular that he came to know was Adolf Hitler. Quoting now from Minister Without Portfolio, speaking of McCloy, he spent an afternoon in Adolf Hitler's box at the Olympic Games, and he still remembers his strong reaction to his hosts. Quote, I knew then that they were a bunch of thugs, unquote. Well, keep in mind that McCloy was Hitler's personal guest at the 1936 Olympics. Ask yourself whether Hitler would have invited someone either who he was unsure of or that he would have disliked to be his guest at the 36 Olympics. And keep in mind also that McCloy's disclaimer here, that he says, I knew then that they were a bunch of thugs. Well, it may be true, but certainly his actions during and after World War II raise some very strong questions about whether or not these represent his sincere sentiments. Talking now about some of McCloy's activities as Assistant Secretary of War and as one of the key people in basically formulating and executing America's wartime policy. That is, wartime policy in World War II. Again, from Minister Without Portfolio by Alan Brinkley. Once America entered the war, McCloy served as Stimson's liaison with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and helped plan most of the major campaigns on both fronts. I'm going to read that sentence again. Once America entered the war, McCloy served as Stimson's liaison with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and helped plan most of the major campaigns on both fronts. He traveled with American troops to North Africa in 1942 and with the advancing armies as they entered Germany in 1944. His hand was visible in wartime legislation regulating labor, conscription, recruitment, promotion, and procurement. There was hardly an area of government with which he did not have dealings at one time or another. He was closely involved as well with some of the most sensitive diplomatic decisions of the war. He helped persuade Roosevelt to accept Stimson's controversial proposal that the United States form an alliance with Admiral Jean Darlan of Vichy France, last name D-A-R-L-A-N. The notorious Nazi collaborator was, McCloy insisted, the only man who could bring French forces in North Africa onto the side of the Allies. Keep in mind that the Vichy French were pro-Nazi French. They basically, like the Tsarist industrialists who allied with Adolf Hitler, were willing to form alliances with foreigners in order to sell out their countrymen for their own benefit.
And they were, in fact, in power in France during the German occupation, which is a key point.
By dint of German arms, okay? But keep in mind that admiration or approval which McCloy had for Admiral Jean Darlan. And keep in mind his presence, his physical presence in North Africa and the fact that he planned most of the major campaigns on both fronts, that is to say the Pacific and European fronts for the United States. So keep in mind John J. McCloy, his being Hitler's personal guest at the 36 Olympics, and we're going to come back to Admiral Jean Darlan and events in North Africa.
Indeed, and we'll be coming back to a lot more because we still have 2 hours of the show yet to go. However, we are going to take a short break for about 5 minutes or so, give you all a chance to get up and stretch your legs, give us a chance to get up and stretch our legs. So once again, for Dave Emery, this is Nip Tuck. We will be back with Hour 3 of Looking Back from 1984, A Hidden History of the Cold War, in just a few minutes here on KFJC 89.7 Los Altos Hills. And welcome back to the final, well, the final half, I should say. We still got 2 hours to go. The final half of tonight's edition of Radio Free America, the archives show. We are going to be on till 11 o'clock tonight. This is Nip Tuck. I'm here in the studios at KFJC with Dave Emery. And you are listening to Looking Back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War. In fact, when I say the second half, it's a little confusing and perhaps even misleading, because tonight's broadcast, all 4 hours of it, is really only the first half of a two-part broadcast. We are going to be airing the second part in May, and we are going to be going on chronologically, more or less, from where we leave off tonight, which is going to be somewhere near the very end of World War II. Anyway, as you heard before, we've been talking about having taken things up from the early days of the Bolshevik Revolution up until the time of the early days and actually during World War II, and cooperation between various Allied governments, Allied industrial sectors, and other sorts with fascism and with the rise of fascism, in many cases for the express purpose of providing a bulwark against the Soviet Union. We're going to be talking in this section of the show to a large extent about some of the things that happened at the close of World War II, and specifically how, you remember, we mentioned at the end of World War I, the Bolshevik Revolution had just taken place. The Bolsheviks were very weak. They were just trying to maintain control over their own country and their own infrastructure, and already the Western world had largely declared war on them and were, in fact, rearming or keeping in place the armed units of the defeated German army at the end of World War I. And as we mentioned earlier in the show, you have to watch out for patterns. We are going to see that pattern developing again here at the end of World War II, and that's what we're going to be talking about in this portion.
Okay, now recall that just before we broke at the top of the hour, we were talking about a man named John J. McCloy. Now, John McCloy was an assistant secretary of war, but basically was one of the linchpins of America's World War II policy. That is to say, he had a great deal to do. One could say was the central figure in planning many of the campaigns in both the Pacific and European theaters, because he was the liaison between the War Department and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. As we've seen, despite his professed anti-Nazi attitude, he was Hitler's personal guest at the 1936 Olympics, and as we saw, he advocated that the United States back a man named Admiral Jean Darlan, last name D-A-R-L-A-N, who was a pro-Nazi French admiral who, according to McCloy, was the only person who could successfully get the French to unite behind our North African campaign. Now, keep in mind Admiral Darlan, keep in mind his fascist sympathies, keep in mind the fact that John J. McCloy was pro-Darlan, and keep in mind the fact that John J. McCloy landed in North Africa with the American Expeditionary Force there, and in general was incredibly influential in formulating America's wartime policy, because we're going to be telling you about some things which occurred on the battlefield during World War II, which most people don't know about. Now, keep in mind the Darlan-McCloy relationship, the fact that McCloy landed with our troops in North Africa and planned many of the campaigns as liaison between the War Department and Joint Chiefs of Staff. Going back now to the book, The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Ries, last name R-I-E-S-S, published in hardcover by Doubleday, Duran and Company, 1944. About the America's landing in North Africa, Ries writes as follows. Extensive preparations were made for our landing in Africa, some of them of a rather romantic nature. Robert Murphy of the State Department was very busy during the weeks preceding the landing. He made his headquarters in the house of a Jewish physician, Dr. Henri Aboulke in Algiers, last name A-B-O-U-L-K-E-R, in Algiers, where he met a great number of the doctor's friends, most of them confirmed de Gaullists, most of them Jews. One of them owned the beach villa to which General Mark Clark came in a submarine to confer about details of the invasion. These men were to organize a few hundred of their friends, furnish them with arms which the United States government had sent for the purpose of seizing such strategic points as the telegraph office, the police department, the power plants, and to arrest any of the leading French officers who they thought might be likely to offer any resistance. Among these was Admiral Darlan. While the plan did not succeed entirely, since the Americans landed many hours later than they were scheduled to, the enormous confusion caused by the presence of the 540 armed men in the city of Algiers and the arrest of so many important officers caused enough distraction to facilitate the American landing considerably. Then immediately after the landing, a lot of things began to look quite different in Algiers as well as elsewhere. The de Gaullists had risked their lives to help the Americans, but it was Admiral Darlin, who had fought General de Gaulle and his followers so mercilessly, who was put in power by us. Interrupting here, keep in mind the sponsorship of the advocacy of General Darlin by John J. McCloy. The Jews had done their utmost to make our invasion possible, but when anti-Semitic French officers who had not aided us demanded that the Jewish interpreters who had facilitated our landing operations be ousted, the interpreters were promptly chased out of the ports. Frenchmen who had shown enthusiasm when the Americans landed were put in prison. Many citizens who had fought for the Americans lost their jobs, while French officers who had fought against them were promoted. Two police officers who had actively assisted the Allies during the landing were arrested because they had not told their superior officers of the imminent invasion. The superior officers stayed in their jobs, although they had been violently anti-American and continued to be so. Now, Mr. Murphy could no longer find time for seeing the old doctor or any of the men he had conferred with so frequently before. In the meantime, Admiral Darlin was assassinated. Officers and officials who had been imprisoned by the army of 540 men during the night of the landings and who had begged on their knees for their lives saw their chance for revenge now. Finally, every one of the group who had helped the Americans, including the old Dr. Aboulkay, was arrested by the French secret police. It was said that they were plotting to assassinate General Giraud, last name G-I-R-A-U-D. During the following weeks, members of French fascist organizations who had hidden out when the Americans came in reappeared on the streets and in the cafes and made no secret of the fact that they were still on the side of Marshal Pétain and against the Americans. The Service d'Ordre de la Légion, the French counterpart of the SS, was even accepted with open arms by our army intelligence. Their intelligence service turned over the names of many suspicious, unquote, persons whom the Americans proceeded to arrest. Most of these were actually de Gaullists or Jews, none of whom belonged to fascist organizations. In the meantime, Mr. Murphy had arranged for Monsieur Marcel Peyrouton, P-E-Y-R-O-U-T-O-N, one of the most faithful of the French collaborationists to go to Algiers. It seemed, in short, that everyone who had helped us to land was being punished, while everyone who had worked against us was being encouraged. Okay, so here basically the United States, with the aid of a number of Jews and socialists, successfully invades North Africa. The Jews and socialists acting basically as commandos and intelligence officers or spies for this landing. Then the very fascist elements we were ostensibly landing to oust are placed back in power. The elements who help us during the course of our invasion are interned. Admiral Darlin, who Assistant Secretary of War McCloy was very high on, is assassinated, and one open question must be, was he assassinated as a provocation or was it a legitimate assassination? In other words, did somebody kill Admiral Darlin in order to produce the reaction which did follow his death, or was that a coincidence? And after Darlin was assassinated, all of the people who aid our landings are interned, and in essence, the French fascists are kept in power in North Africa, despite the fact that ostensibly American arms put into North Africa to oust fascism from power.
Now, two questions raised by what Dave was just talking about need to be addressed here. Well, the first is not really a question. The first is a pattern. Now, in North Africa, one may look at this happenstance, as Dave described it, of the Americans landing, all of the people who aided the Americans, the local partisan groups, the Jews, the leftists, etc., aiding the Americans to land and then promptly being imprisoned, chased off, punished, whatever, and the reins of power being promptly turned over back over to the local fascist elements. People might say, well, that is a pretty weird situation. You know, obviously there was something strange about North Africa. However, as you are going to see in some of the upcoming readings this hour, next hour, and in the next show we're going to do, this was the rule rather than the exception, and it suggests more than a mere isolated odd event. It suggests policy. Now, the other thing Dave mentioned was the assassination of Admiral Darlin and a provocation of some sort. Well, those of you out there who are not familiar with this kind of thing might say, well, yeah, that seems kind of a weird thing to bring up. I mean, you know, why wasn't it just an assassination? It was wartime. Why would it be a provocation? Well, again, if you listen to the rest of this show and some of the other shows we're doing, you will see once again this falls into the pattern of provocation. And as soon as we finish up with North Africa, we're going to talk about Greece, and you'll begin to understand what we're talking about.
Keep in mind that provocation and fascism have tended to go hand in hand, that the Nazis actually achieved their dictatorial powers in Germany when Hitler was elected chancellor, and then the Nazis burned down the Reichstag building, the German parliamentary building, blamed it on the communists, and used that as an excuse to basically suspend all civil liberties in Germany. And the rest, as they say, is history. So fascism and provocation are two very common bedfellows, so it's not an unreasonable question to ask here.
Okay, now continuing on from the book, The Nazis Go Underground, we're going to be reading a little bit more here about North Africa. Now this gets a bit complicated. The main thing here is to just once again look at patterns that we're talking about here. We're talking again about the collusion between industrial and banking elements on an international scale, regardless of any what might be called purely national loyalties. Loyalty in these cases obviously is to money above and beyond all else at whatever cost. So bear that in mind as we read this next section. Continuing from The Nazis Go Underground. When we landed in Africa, General Giraud was there ready to assume the command of the French troops. Soon it became known that the general was not the choice of the French men who were eager to liberate themselves. He had never shown any partiality for democracy. He had always been a reactionary and a loyalist, meaning loyal in this case to the Vichy government. On top of this, he was, even for a long time after the invasion, a man who believed in Marshal Pétain and who wanted to serve the old marshal. At first, it seemed as though General Giraud had been selected by the governments in Washington and London as the liberator. However, the real instigators of this choice were French industrialists, the brothers de Wendel, spelled W-E-N-D-E-L, Perimoff de Fontenelle, Pierre-Étienne Flandin, Pierre Pouchou, and others, not to speak of the dozens of generals and hundreds of minor officers who arrived in Africa at the time General Giraud did. When we, meaning the Americans, landed in Africa, we found there quite a sizable group of Frenchmen, who usually did not reside in that part of the world. We also found many billions of francs in African banks, which had not been there a short time before. There had been a leak somewhere, and a few French industrialists, or were they German, had not been slow to profit from it. Now, bear in mind that when the United States came into the war, in many ways, the tide of the war began to turn. That was the turning point when America's industrial effort and its immense industrial reserves could be brought to bear on the war effort on behalf of the Allies. Many of the supporters and collaborators throughout Europe who may have supported the Nazis philosophically were aware that the Nazis probably could not hold out, although there may have been some doubt, and in many cases began shipping money out of the countries, money that they had gotten their hands on in the first place because of their collaboration with the Nazis, in order to prepare their way in the post-war world to retain their positions of power. Now, this is something we're going to see time and again.
Worth noting, too, that right at the same period of time when the U.S. entered the war, December of 1941, the Red Army launched its first serious counteroffensive on the Eastern Front in Europe, driving the Wehrmacht from the gates of Moscow. And the German General Staff's plan had been to take the Soviet Union before the onset of the Russian winter, so that pro-fascist fascist sympathizers and fascists in Europe had sort of a double whammy to look at in December of 1941. The United States, with its huge manufacturing capacity, its huge base of raw materials and population, had just entered the war on the side of the Allies, and at the same time, the Soviet Union had not been eliminated during the first winter, and the German plan called for that, and the Red Army was on the offensive. So it really, things were looking very bleak at that period of time for the cause of fascism.
Okay, now again, Reese is talking about the when the Americans landed in North Africa, they discovered an amazing amount of capital, mostly in francs, that had not been in North Africa shortly before. Reese writes as follows. The story goes back to November 1941, when a Franco-German trust was formed to control African raw material bases. This trust was capitalized, meaning started out at 8 million francs. 51% of its shares were taken over by IG Farben, the rest by leading French chemical concerns. Both the German government and Vichy approved. The Nazi press proclaimed that a new economic era had begun with the creation of this new enterprise. Soon afterwards, another Franco-German trust, the French Trans-African Company, was formed, the shareholders being two leading French banks, which in turn were owned by the Deutsche Bank in Berlin, as well as by a number of German industrial firms. Thus, ever since the end of 1941, French North Africa was industrially as well as financially under the complete control of Germany. Then, sometime during 1942, an important Frenchman found out about the invasion plans. He spoke of it to one of the top men in the Comité des Forges, an association of leading mining industries, a certain Pierre Puchu, P-U-C-H-E-U, who was also a director of the Banque Worm in Paris, which had participated in the French Trans-African Company and of which the Deutsche Bank held the majority of shares. Banque Worm also represented the interests of the Schroeder Bank at Cologne, the same Schroeder who had started financing Hitler with money from the German heavy industries in 1928. Puchu talked about the impending invasion to a number of bankers, among them Briard de Boissonger, who had close contacts with IG Farben and other German industrial enterprises. Boissonger was also a Vichy representative on the board of directors of the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, where he was in constant touch with Hjalmar Schacht. That, of course, is the finance minister, the German finance minister, who was in close contact also with the British banker Montague Norman, as we mentioned in the last hour. Thus, via Puchu and Boissonger, a great many people learned of the invasion, who were not supposed to know about it. Among them, Schacht, Herr von Schroeder, and, of course, Baron von Schnitzler. And only a few days after the news leaked out, the two German-French trusts in North Africa began to transfer all available money from their banks in Paris to branches of the Banque de Paris and the Union Parisienne in Algiers and Morocco. At the same time, other French enterprises poured money into North Africa. One who transferred large sums was François de Wendel, regent of the Banque de France and head of the Wendel Steel Corporation. And also, it should be noted, a close friend of Fritz Thyssen. Thyssen was a German steel magnate who was also a big financier of the Nazis.
Also, you heard a reference to Herr von Schnitzler. He was a key member of the key director of IG Farben.
Indeed. Now, once again, I want to make this point. Now, here the Germans, through Hjalmar Schacht and the French Vichy supporters, the pro-Nazi French industrialists, have discovered that the Americans are going to be invading North Africa. Well, now, you might think at this time, if these people were real diehards and real, going to fight to the death for their countries, et cetera, that they would be indeed withdrawing money from Africa, you know, where it might be in danger, et cetera, if they felt that there was a danger that the U.S.